And my great fear is when I get up to the microphone is that I will mix up all the speeches and come out screaming about the CIA pissing in the nuclear plants in order to radiate the water, to poison the minds of the youth, in order to make them easy cannon fodder for the Pentagon's next war in Central America.
They chose to follow in the footsteps of George Bush with a night of media bashing.
The first point to understand is if you think that the function of Channel 3 or the Burlington Free Press is to educate you about the world in which you're living, it's not. The function of private media is to make money for the people who own the media. It is a business.
So the result is that we have freedom to write, freedom to speak, but we don't have freedom to have a mass audience.
They know the media loves it.
It didn't take me long to figure out in career of being a troublemaker that if you wanted to get ideas out into the marketplace, if you wanted to make change in America, you had to very quickly recognize that entertainment had been elevated on the hierarchy of needs up there with love and nourishment and self-esteem, etc. And
Tom Grant, Channel 3 News, Burlington.
What does that mean? And I want to go from the general to the personal. If you are a mayor or a serious public official, well, they got bored, they're leaving, all right. If you are a serious public official, how do you deal with the complex issues that your city faces or your state faces, and you look at that camera and you say, oh God, I got 30 seconds to do it. And then you understand why politicians become morons.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to Struggle Session. I'm Leslie Lee III.
Oh, and I'm Katie Halper, the first.
Katie, you are co-hosting this very special episode of our show because Jack, refused to. He is on strike for this episode.
Wow.
A little backstory. For people who heard Jack and I on our special guest appearance on the West Wing thing, I said on that episode that we would never ever do an Aaron Sorkin show or movie on Struggle Session. And Jack was so excited and happy to hear that. And then just maybe a week later, I got a DM that made me have to, you know, readjust that promise that I made to Jack. So he's on strike. He's refusing to do the episode. But Katie is subbing in. I just want to thank you so much, Katie, for coming on and really crossing a picket line.
I know. I'm
really
a scab. I was going to say it. It's my first time being a scab.
To be on this episode. And the DM I got were from some great people at this amazing podcast called Impressions of America. And they're the guests on our show because they wanted to talk about this movie, The Trial of the Chicago 7. And today we have Toby and Vaughn with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So they're like Thank the you. Goons who made this happen, who made you break
yes.
the strike. They're the goons.
Got it. For people who haven't heard your show, tell them about your podcast.
Well, the podcast is really about American history since maybe 1945. We're just trying to take people from the post-war liberal consensus and just show them how it was shattered and how basically we have the world that we have today.
You seem to both have accents, yet you're talking about America. Why are Vaughn? Why are you doing a podcast about America?
Well, Vaughn's
you're not American.
How?
Yeah, oh, Vaughn is American.
Surprisingly, I am American. I'm from Philly, but I live in London. I'm doing a PhD in London.
And you're already converted. I already can tell from your voice you're already converted. You're
yeah,
assimilationist.
Mm-hmm. That transatlantic accent.
Yeah.
The William Buckley.
George Plimpton, a veritable George Plimpton.
Well, I did a master's degree in sort of American history, really associate with Theodore Roosevelt, because I saw it like as the real beginning of the kinds of modern liberalism that we have today. But I never really got a chance to do any post-war stuff. So me and my friend Simon who's up in Scotland and was the original host of the Impressions of America, just came up with this idea of trying to explore all of these questions, all these very contemporary questions that I never got to explore.
Is this like some kind of a cult, you know, going native cultural anthropology thing?
And Vaughn, I was actually looking at your bio, and you study film propaganda, more or less. Yes.
Yes, I do. I study Christmas films from the early Cold War period for like anti-communist sentiments and pro-American propaganda. So I look at like It's a Wonderful Life, White Christmas, Miracle on 34th Street. It's a very fun project.
Yeah, so are you going to be doing a War on Christmas episode this year where you cancel
I freeze
all our
or
favorite
other people freeze?
Holiday films?
So we are doing a Christmas special, actually. Sometime in December, just before Christmas, we'll be covering some of my own research with older Christmas films and then probably talking about some more contemporary ones, because awful Christmas films are my absolute favorite genre. So I'm going to shoehorn it in.
Katie, are there any Hanukkah films that are secretly anti-communist propaganda?
I don't know. I don't think, well, there certainly weren't any made back in those days. Although a lot of Jews wrote a lot of Christmas songs, by the way. I wrote a post, I did something about that once, I think, some listicle. We can get into another time. But no, I'm a Christmas tree Jew anyway. The only holiday I celebrate is Passover.
I really hope we're not doing It's a Wonderful Life, though. It's kind of saccharine. Most Christmas films are really
How
saccharine.
How dare you? No, it's we're definitely talking It's a Wonderful Life.
Can we just do Die Hard, please? I mean, come on.
What else is there?
Sound like my supervisor.
Home Alone.
Gremlins 2. All right, so let's get into our movie today. The Trial of the Chicago 7. Aaron Sorkin. Mr. Shut up, you goddamn woman, and listen to me tell you what really matters. He wrote and directed this movie. You know, people who listen to the show know how I feel about Aaron Sorkin. I'm not a fan of him. I really despise The West Wing on a visceral level, as well as The Newsroom. But I have to say, watching this movie, this Netflix produced movie where he did not have the money to do 90 minutes of walk and talks, and people just had to sit down and have believable conversations with one another, this one was more or less, on just the surface level as a film, pretty okay. I did not necessarily had a bad time watching. We'll talk about the politics and the actual history of this trial later, but I just want to, on the surface level, what did everyone think about this movie?
I thought it was really fun. You know, I thought the characters, as you say, they had genuine interactions. People like Tom Hayden and people like Sacha Baron Cohen's character, they seemed to be written as the characters like Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden in the past. There was a lot of good, quite flashy scenes with police knocking people. Like, it was very visceral at times. It was funny. It was entertaining. And I think they really captured, in terms of a lot of the motion stuff, they really captured what it was like in the 60s to some extent, I think. Yeah, I thought it was fun. But I also do think, and we'll probably touch on this later, that in Sorkin's sort of love of American institutions, even in the courtroom where you have like a really difficult judge who's like clearly a racist, Sorkin still, he does a lot of the stuff that he did in West Wing, a lot of the stuff he did in A Few Good Men, and it does not escape that sort of staid, quite conservative liberalism that he's known for.
Yeah, I thought it was very enjoyable. It was good. I wasn't, you know, I was engaged the whole time. I was moved. At some points, you know, I laughed a lot. I didn't cry. So I can't say I laughed. I cried. It was a roller coaster of emotions. I did get a little emotional at the end, which we'll talk about later, which I feel very guilty about. But yeah, I thought it was great. I thought Sacha Baron Cohen was great. I thought everyone was great. I thought the guy who played Jerry Rubin, who is that? He looks like he could be related to Judah Friedlander.
Jeremy Strong?
Is that who it is?
Yeah, I kept
parsing him in my mind as like Jason Mantzoukas,
That's what I thought it was at first when I first saw him for like a second. Then I realized it obviously wasn't him. Yeah.
I really loved it. I thought it was very enjoyable. I've in a past life studied a lot about 1968. So I thought it was a very interesting kind of ordering of events that happened in 1968.
Yeah, that's one way to phrase it.
Yeah. Yes. But I think it was very compelling as a film text itself being an interpretation of a historical event. And also I was just like nerding out constantly about the set design. There were certain paintings at certain points in the film that I was like, oh my God, yes. It was so good. And the editing between like within the riot scenes, cutting between the actual footage from like historical footage and the film, it was seamless for me. And I thought this was a spectacular film. I enjoyed it a lot. Sacha Baron Cohen was excellent as Abby Hoffman. I really enjoyed it.
Jack is going to be extremely upset that we're praising a Sorkin film so much when he hears about this. But yeah, I really just felt like if he did stuff like this, like he would be much better, like a creator. Like it just is a lot more. You know, like, I don't know. It just feels more like he's doing less coke. That's basically what it feels like. He did a lot less cocaine. He couldn't get cocaine while he was filming this movie. And like, it takes its time. It's not trying to do a joke a minute, which he does in a lot of his shows. It's like fucking Yakky Sax. Like he's doing jokes constantly and all his other stuff where he, you know, his jokes are still bad, I think, for the most part in this one. And they recycle, some of the jokes. Like the one is enough. That's in like the West Wing, like exact same scenario, exact same everything. But you know, besides the self, you know, plagiarization, I on the whole, like this was like one of the better things that he's done. So I gotta give it up to him on a craft level. Now on a political level, I think is where the problem starts. So, I know y'all are familiar with this history. So can you kind of lay out what the real history is of this trial of the Chicago 8/7? Why we're not sure how many we should say, people, what number we should call it, why it's one of the like most fucked up things in American history that's happened, but nobody ever really talks about it. This is my first time learning about it. So if Toby and Vaughn, if you could, you know, kind of break down that history.
Essentially what the riots were that this film is about happened during the Democratic National Convention in August of 1968. And leading up to the convention, the Democratic Party really had a split base because the largest kind of the most vocal part of the electorate wanted an anti-Vietnam War candidate. Uh-huh. And the DNC was poising to put up Hubert Humphreys, who was a pro-war candidate, or at least not de-escalation candidate.
This sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah. Doesn't like, it? Yeah.
I mean, it is funny because Humphrey actually internally, he was very, very deeply unsure about the war, like other Democratic candidates, like RFK, for example. But because he really, really wanted the presidency, he just basically did whatever Lyndon Johnson said and became a pro-war candidate.
And it was very much against the electorate base of the Democratic Party. RFK, Robert Kennedy, was doing very well and won many primaries up to that date. And then he was assassinated. And it left this kind of power vacuum within the Democratic Party, which is where the DNC felt comfortable just shoving Hubert Humphreys into that spot. So at the DNC, it was held in Chicago, August 68. They were anticipating massive protests from groups that are represented in the film. So the Students for a Democratic Society, the mobilization for the end of the Vietnam War, Youth International Party, which are the Yippies of Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. And then a lot of other kind of groups as well, including the Black Panthers and others. So thousands of people were planning to come to Chicago to protest the Democratic National Convention. And in response to that, Mayor Daley of Chicago, and probed by the DNC, he ordered in the Illinois National Guard to protect the convention center. And they also brought in police from all around the state to be crowd control. So tensions were extremely high during the convention. I think it was, what, like 4 or 5 days of the convention? And there were protests and rallies and just events constantly happening within Chicago at Lincoln Park, where these protests and rallies and riots break out in the film and in real life, which is about 10 miles away from the convention center, but very near to the Hilton Hotel, where all of the delegates were staying during the convention. Protests are happening. They clash with police. There are the riots.
This is a key point in the film. There's DNC protests now every time, and there's permits, and there's places where people are allowed to protest, and they had set up the big barricades and shut down the subway stations to cordon off the area for all the VIPs in the green zone. But that wasn't the standard practice yet at the time, right?
I think they failed to give the protesters the permits, even though, like, Ramsey Clark, who's in this movie, had said that actually it was a real failure on the side of the Chicago administrators to not give them the permits, because people who were clashing against the war, who were, you know, vocal against the war, had a First Amendment right to be there. And he also, one of the other failures was that the police force was already, you know, was set up to attack many of the protesters by Mayor Daley. So this kind of illegal violence that was used by the police force was actually the center of this story. But Ramsey Clark is ousted once Hubert Humphrey is defeated by Richard Nixon, and then John Mitchell comes in as the Attorney General, and then Mayor Daley and John Mitchell sort of put a grand jury together, and instead of going after the police force, they try to find scapegoats from the protesters to pin an incitement to riot charge on them. And they pick the seven at plus Bobby Seale, who had been talking earlier, you know, in late August in Chicago, but he was not part of the riots at all. But he was pinned as the eighth member of the Chicago Seven.
Mm-hmm. And then they had these givebacks, as Sacha Baron, as Abbie Hoffman is written. I mean, in this film, right? Calls them. Who are these two other people? I guess from SDS.
So Lee Weiner and John Freunds.
Yeah,
they were the kind of like softer two options that the jury could acquit and feel good about themselves for acquitting someone while also prosecuting the other, ultimately five of the seven, after Bobby Seale is separated from the case.
Yeah. And just so we are clear about, you know, the real stakes and the casualties that happened at the because of these riots, like exactly how many targets were damaged during the riots? Were there any Starbucks who had their windows smashed at all while this happened?
There was some property damage, but surprisingly, that wasn't the main kind of concern of most people viewing the riots.
Yeah. So, like, how many people were hurt by how many people did the cops hurt?
I don't actually know the exact numbers, but from what I remember, and this might just be me pulling this out of nowhere, I believe there was about 8,000 people who had clashed with the police and had some form of injury after the fact.
after 4 days and nights of violence. This is The Guardian, by the way, that I'm quoting here. After 4 days and nights of violence, where did violence come from? Who knows? It's just violence. Okay. 668 people had been arrested. 425 demonstrators were treated at temporary medical facilities. Okay. 200 were treated on the spot. 400 given first aid for tear gas exposure, and 110 went to the hospital. A total of 192 police officers were injured. I gotta say, that's a nice ratio. I have to say, that's a nice ratio. We can get those numbers up.
We can do it, guys.
We can get the KD up. All right.
People have said that, you know, this year, because of COVID and George Floyd, that we've had mass protests and there've been a lot of clashes with the police. But this is almost nothing compared to what happened in 68. In 67 and 68, you had riots all over America with massive amount of property damage and thousands of people hurt and a few people dying at many of these riots. This was a kind of cultural upheaval that we don't really get anymore.
Like the hearing the number of like bombings that happened in like the 70s is just a staggering number that we have nothing to really compare to now. And it's just, there was so much radical energy that was, of course, crushed and repressed. And ostensibly, that's kind of what this movie is supposed to be about. The government cracked down on radicals and how they quashed the movement, except for the fact that, and this is my main beef with the film's politics, that Aaron Sorkin is not really sure which side he's on for any of this movie. It's not very clear. Like the main argument kind of that is happening in the film is like, is it okay to be like radical as opposed to like, wow, this is an extremely belligerent, fucked up prosecution that is a complete injustice and should never have happened. Like those people have to, like the radicals have to prove themselves that they are being persecuted by the end of the film. Like they don't, like most people would probably jump in from the perspective of the side of the, you know, people who are the people who are being oppressed. But this film starts from the perspective of the prosecutor, of Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing the real life prosecutor Schultz, who, and this is another problem with the film because it changes a lot of the history. The actual prosecutor of this case is still alive. In the film, he's portrayed as being, you know, kind of straight down the road, conservative, straight laced about the law. And he was resistant, you know, to trying this case, but eventually he was convinced to do it. In real life, the prosecutor says no, he wasn't, he had no problem with doing it at all.
Well, obviously, I mean, he took liberties, right, with apparently, I didn't know that, but that's kind of interesting that he had the prosecutor be much more sympathetic than he actually was. You saw this as kind of the moral upstanding guy who was disturbed when Bobby Seale was bound and gagged and chained. Although it's not, I mean, he was you could see through the acting that he kind of was viscerally disturbed. But of course, what he says to the judge is that there needs to be a mistrial for him, for Bobby Seale. Mm-hmm.
The thing about that scene is that in the movie, that's like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. In reality, he was bound for 2.5 days.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
In court. So that's you know, insane. That completely changes like how that plays out and how you perceive. Because even watching that scene, you get the feeling like the judge feels bad about it. Like you get the feeling that the judge feels bad about what he did.
I don't actually think that. I think he feels, I mean, I don't think that's, for me, the feeling was, oh, he realizes this, you know, William Kunstler's character says, you got to do a retrial because, grant him a mistrial. Sorry, a mistrial, right?
Yeah.
Because you just made the black guy look sympathetic. So I think that the kind of urgency in the judge's eyes reflects like more of an, oh shit, I just gave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of, Yeah, I mean, I thought it was kind of like a bit of both. Like, it was like, oh, I fucked up, and also, like, I've gone too far. Because they kind of portray him as kind of being, like, senile. And, like, they portray him as being,
senile. It was kind of a portrayal, because he wasn't... Ramsey Clark has said that this judge wasn't temperamentally suited for the kind of volatility that this case was going to bring out. So he was like that. And he was as old and as... sort of a fossil who probably shouldn't have been there, as he is being depicted by Frank Langella. But yeah,
who does a great job, by the way.
Bobby
Seale actually tried, while he was bound and gagged, to get out of the gag during the trial for ages, and it sent a message out to people who were watching the trial of how much of an injustice that this was. But yeah, it was.
Right.
It's very different. And Bobby Seale was actually much more belligerent than he was in the film, you know, calling him a fascist, a pig.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the film really, although it engages, it says, you know, clearly the judge is a racist or he's acting out of turn. It doesn't really engage that much with what really happened between them and with the Black Panthers, not just as a group of sort of anti-racist sort of a civil rights group, but actually a group that promoted violent resistance against the government and deep subversion. Bobby Seale comes out as a much more clean cut a character that's easy to identify with from the perspective of sort of like normal suburban, even conservatives.
Yeah, and I actually kind of think that's a lie I'll forgive, right? Like, if you, like, making the Black Panthers look, like, maybe a little bit softer and gentler, like, I'm actually kind of okay with that fictional aspect.
Seale did actually get out of his bind at one point while he was chained. And by kind of, like, removing that whole struggle that he was having, literally being bound and gagged in
a struggle
an American
session, if
courtroom.
You will.
By kind of removing that, it showed that, like, the government in this courtroom was, like, very effective at silencing him. And I think that's a pretty shit message to send, because the government never really succeeded in stifling the Black Panthers in the way that they kind of portrayed in this film. And I think that's a kind of narrowly missed historical point.
Yeah, there's a number to get to, because even, like, I mean, the Fred Hampton stuff, which was weird because it was exaggerated because Fred Hampton wasn't actually in the trial like that, or giving Bobby Seale advice, but it also, like, pulled back on the thing. If you're going to put Fred Hampton in a movie, isn't the main thing you want to put in the fact that the Chicago PD and the FBI conspired to kill him? Like, don't you, like, would you not, like, I understand maybe it was not known at the time definitively as we do now, but it was certainly suspected. And hey, your camera can go anywhere. You can show the FBI agents planning to murder him if you want. Like, I didn't understand, like, why would you leave that aspect
you're saying that they could have dramatic because they tell us that, right? But you're saying, like, why didn't they dramatically represent that part? I mean, we know he's executed, right? So
yes
they can say I jump that, in
yeah.
there
yeah.
Oh yes, please.
So this is a part of the reordering of events that's kind of problematic, because Bobby Seale was bound and gagged on the 29th of October in real life, the 29th of October. And on November 6th, he was granted a mistrial. So he was separated from everything then. And then Fred Hampton was murdered in his home in the exact same way as was depicted and discussed in December. So it didn't happen during the trial. Yeah.
I think Sorkin just added it in post-production, that scene. The death of Fred Hampton, because I think something had happened with Breonna Taylor, and Sorkin felt deeply that he needed to add that into the movie.
Ah, that's interesting. Really? That is Interesting.
That is really interesting. So, Leslie, your point is, like, if you're going to mention that part, so, like, chronology aside, because now we know that it didn't happen that way, right? Is your point, like, if you're going to have that, you should have that be part of a scene?
Yeah, you should have the part that everyone talks about, which is that he was murdered by the FBI and the Chicago PD, and it was an operation run by them. Like, why shove it in and just leave it out? The only person who says the cops killed him are actually Bobby. That comes out of Bobby Seale's mouth. And even though he's generally portrayed sympathetically, I think all the activists kind of are, more or less. You can't believe everything that they say. They're constantly, you know, proving wrong or to be boastful or to be lying. Some of them lie at times. The movie never fully is on side of the activists. So Bobby Seale saying, "Oh, the pigs killed him," like, that is still, like, kind of a question. Like, if you watch this movie, you actually have to look it up, because otherwise you just come away thinking, "Oh, that's just Bobby's radical guy's opinion, and these radicals, yeah, they seem pretty good, but sometimes they go too far, so maybe it didn't happen that way."
Permission to treat the co-host as hostile.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I object. No, I think that actually, I mean, I think what you're saying is true. I think I disagree with your a little bit with your the overall question of the sympathy towards the radicals, towards the activists. But even if we think that there's some ambiguity there, I do actually think that you were supposed to not question Bobby Seale's rendition of it, because you see him say that he was told, and the point that he makes about being shot in the shoulder, which renders you unable to shoot a gun, and then he says, "Make sure you look that up in the report." I don't remember what he says, but make sure they talk about that. My sense from that was, like, it is absolutely indisputable that it happened this way.
But I guess my thing is, like, you could have actually just shown it happen.
Yes.
Like,
and
there, and it didn't seem like there was any reason not to.
And just to assist Katie, I would also say that I think continuously in the movie that the side of the prosecution is shown to be morally pretty bad. I think the use of jury tampering as well on the side of the prosecution is one of the points that outlined this. There's a juror number six, who goes in, and the judge tells her that the Black Panthers have written a note to her family, but they made up the note, didn't they?
It was only like a couple of bad apples. Yeah. Joseph Gordon-Levitt had nothing to do with any of those nefarious tactics, and he was just as upset as we were when he saw them go down, and he continued with the prosecution.
Right. No, that's definitely true. He was, I mean, it, to the extent to which he's either, like, he's the outlier or they're the outliers, I think is an interesting one. But they definitely unnecessarily humanize part of the prosecution, right? Especially since we know that he wasn't like that. Although I wonder if that makes him more persuasive or better propaganda to reach people.
I think Gordon-Levitt comes off as a sort of, like, Frank Capra type character. He's young, handsome. He's a lawyer.
Yeah.
He's up and coming. And he has a moral center, even though he's playing for the home team here, I think so.
Yeah, and he is a good father, cute with the kids, gives his kids the candy the mom won't let them have.
When you think about it, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and I'm looking this up, he has, like, literally never been a bad guy in a movie, except for G.I. Joe, when he's covered entirely in makeup. Like, you cannot possibly tell it's him. He's never been a villain. So even casting him like this, you know, boyish, charming, good-looking actor who's always playing, you know, the good guy is a choice. It's a choice from Sorkin have him be, you know, the prosecutor instead of one of the
actors. It has a material effect on the narrative in many ways. It's just like casting Tom Hanks in that role. I mean, what would you supposed to think about the guy?
Yes.
Right. And again, just the narrative aspect, you know, showing him feeling some kind of ambivalence, when that's so funny, Leslie, that the guy was like, "Nope, I was fine with that." It's like a pretty big tell.
Like, he was fine with it even after he saw the movie.
Jesus
Christ. Like, so what does that say about the movie, really? Yeah. Like, if somebody's like, looks at this, this portrayal, and they say, "Actually, what I would change is that they would make me less ambivalent about everything that happens." So how bad can, like, the condemnation of the prosecution actually be if the prosecutor who is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt as like a almost like an Atticus fucking Finch, right? And like he's saying, actually, no, I do want to take credit for all of that.
A lot of people also said the judge was worse, more of a monster than he was portrayed to be in the film. And you know, they omitted the best line from that trial, which is when Abbie Hoffman says to Julius Hoffman, you're a Shonda for the Goyim, which means basically you are a shame in front of non-Jews. Like you're like blowing up our spot. Shonda is shame, Goyim is non-Jews. So Shonda for the Goyim, that's what it means. It's like, you know, you're embarrassing us in front of from non-Jews, which it's there's a
similar of like a Uncle Tom, perhaps.
I do think it is. I wonder if there must be a Yiddish word for Uncle Tom. What is Uncle? I can't remember. Anyway, I'll try to figure it out. But there was a very interesting like Jew on Jew conflict in there in that courtroom, because Julius Hoffman was a— oh, and that was really funny. I don't know. I see, the thing that drives me crazy about historical films is I always want to know what exactly is quoted and what isn't. So I think he did say father when he said we're not related.
Yes, that's that was real, right? That
which
was
is
real.
Hilarious.
That was
absolutely
real.
Hilarious. But, you know, Julius Hoffman was like a German Jew. So those are German, not— he wasn't born in Germany. His ancestors were German Jews. They're the fancy Jews. And Abbie Hoffman is from the like Eastern European stock. They're the not as fancy Jews. And apparently, I was reading an article, apparently Hoffman made another activist who was on the stand take off his kippah, his yarmulke, which is interesting because that's another kind of performative thing. Like you have to be, you know, respectability politics, can't be too religious. Of course, I mean, oh, and then William Kunstler, of course, was Jewish. I mean, he and Abbie Hoffman were Jews, like I'm a Jew, which is, you know, secular and culturally Jewish and, you know, didn't care about marrying Jews or non-Jews, that type. Also, though, I got to say one thing, which is that Kunstler, I don't know if you've ever heard his voice in real life, but he has a very distinct voice, which that actor did not achieve at all. Although he was a good actor, but...
Was that lawyer as cool in real life?
Kunstler or Wineglass?
Counselor.
I think so, but I think he's— unless it changed, he was much more of a kind of almost more Abbie Hoffman-esque in his performative nature. Mm-hmm. He was in Law and Order. But yeah, he was, you know, he defended the Weather Underground, Attica Prisoners.
He defended MLK as well.
And AIM, the American Indian Movement, Black Panthers, RCP.
See, this is like, why wasn't any of that in the movie? I actually feel like the movie kind of like did not really try to tie this, you know, younger, more radical aspect of the movement as much as it could have to the ones that, you know, liberals already like the MLK, you know, like there wasn't— there's some clips of MLK, but they could have done more to make it seem like a holistic thing. Like the only black people you see in this are Black Panthers, right? There's no non-Black Panther black people in there. So you just think of them as the Black Panthers as opposed to the civil rights movement.
But then
to
play
large.
Devil's advocate, the SDS and the Yippies and the Black Panthers saw themselves as different from the older liberal movements that had come before. They saw themselves, whereas the Black Panthers waging violent resistance against the American government, which was the antithesis of Martin Luther King's nonviolent procedure. And I guess the SDS and the Yippies as well, they saw themselves as part of a counterculture that was very much against everything that the older culture had stood for. They were for radical authenticity, or almost like a Dionysian cult of youth and nature. And a lot of these things were very, very different from the liberalism that was before. And I think the people like Kunstler, people like Ramsey Clark become in many ways the typical heroes of the Sorkin story, and they are much more in line with that kind of liberalism. But I do think that the film really fails to really engage with the ideas of the SDS, the ideas of the Yippies, and the ideas of the Black Panthers, because that's not really Sorkin's politics at all.
Yeah, yeah. Right. This is the least political film I've ever seen, really, because it's really not about the actual politics. And that's why I said, like, at least tie it to, like, MLK, so at least you're tricking the libs into, like, liking the Black Panthers. Like, oh, it's all, you know, like, they're like, lie. I'm asking for some good propaganda.
Well, which,
like,
is why you appreciated the softening of Bobby Seale, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you're going to lie in that mood, that shifts the conversation a bit more to the left, at least, you know?
You know, it's interesting, though, because he, you know, the most MLK-like character in the in that cast of characters on the you know, being tried was actually Dellinger, who's white, so important difference. But he was very committed to nonviolence as a tactic and discipline and moral cause, because he was a conscientious objector, I guess, in World War II. Again, I'm pretty sure that's true. I can look that up. But who knows, with Sorkin taking so many liberties, such liberties. And I don't know, did he really punch a guard during the trial the way he did in the film?
No.
Do we know? He did not?
No.
Okay.
No, no, that guy was like a ultra pacifist.
No, I know, but I mean the point of that was that he lost his temper and
that did not happen.
Yeah. Abby Hoffman had a hilarious line. I don't think it was in the trial, but just to give you a sense of his Jewish sense of humor. Apparently he said, like, some people were, there was a discussion about abortion, and he said he had a Jewish view of life, which is that it doesn't start until the fetus has graduated from medical school.
Talking on the kind of politics of the film, the politics of the trial in real life was much more culturally relevant than the film kind of suggests. The film really frames it as this is a political trial. All 27 or 37 witnesses they called were police who were undercover. Whereas in reality, there were witnesses like Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg and all of these kind of like cultural movement people who spoke on behalf of the radicals and kind of explained the mindset of the new radicalism that they're defending. So I think that was definitely kind of a missed opportunity from Sorkin to really he really chose a side in framing it as the quote political trial, as he does, because that's like a recurring theme in it that they keep saying this. And Tom Hayden's character, Tom Hayden says at one point, the cultural revolution is getting in the way of the actual revolution. And that's not explored enough, I think, because that's like the kind of main disagreement that Abby Hoffman and Tom Hayden have, that Abby's much more about the culture and Tom wants to win elections so they can change laws.
I was shocked when I actually, because that is just West Wing talk. That's just, I do not believe anybody who could possibly be called a radical and be put on trial would ever like say that. I'm sorry. That just seems like completely absurd to me.
I think the defense really had a two-pronged strategy. The strategy on one sense was trying to make sure that the conspiracy point and the incitement to riot point were dismissed by the jurors. But on the other side, they really were waging a cultural battle against America and much of American life. Like having Allen Ginsberg and Timothy Leary and Norman Mailer come to the stand, that was the real meat and the heart of much of their defense. So on the prosecution side, you do actually have a very realistic view of what happens with people, with the police officers and people who failed to give the Festival of Light permits. But on the side of the fence, it doesn't really come out. Like Allen Ginsberg said things like, you know, politics has become theater in this country. We're attacking the lifestyle of this country. It's intolerable. The large violence, the that the planet is dying, that our children are going to have a worse future than we're having because the planet is dying. So this sort of deep left-wing politics that permeated much of the SDS and the Yippies doesn't come out at all in this movie. And I think, but I also think that there's an interesting thing about the Allen Ginsberg thing, because Allen Ginsberg said that, and then what the prosecution did is they tried to dismiss Ginsberg by bringing up some of his gay poetry, poetry he talked about sleeping with men or saliva and other things that he was doing with men, and they try to use that to dismiss him. And it's like that is, and the issue of trying to dismiss someone because on homophobia is something Sorkin could have explored. It isn't something that's particularly left wing anymore. It's something that I think liberal audiences would enjoy and would absorb and would support. But Sorkin doesn't deal with that issue at all. And I think it shows how deeply conservative Sorkin is.
Yeah, let's jump to the ending, which I have to say, even though I on the whole enjoyed the movie, probably one of the most insulting things I've ever seen on film. It did not happen this way. It's actually strange for a movie that's about a trial. They actually skip the verdict, right? They don't show you the guilt, actual guilt. I don't even think you see the closing arguments. It's like they end one day, and then the next time you see them, they've already been found guilty of numerous charges, and you see the sentencing. And how the film, like a real life movie, ends is that the Hayden character, who is the more liberal electoral focused political radical who has been kind of trying to be the voice of reason, but actually it's his fault that the riot started because he said one word wrong. That's not true. That's not reality.
That's
but,
not true. Yeah, I was wondering.
Yeah, but that's what the trial hangs on. So he basically loses them the case. So he is kind of presented as kind of being weak and not really down with the cause like the others up to this point. So he proves himself by standing up during the sentencing, and instead of asking the judge, who likes him among all the defendants, he only likes, Kennedy-like guy. He stands up and he reads off the names of all the soldiers who died, died since the trial started in Vietnam. U.S. casualties, only U.S. casualties.
Yeah.
And that's very pointed and specific. Like, during this whole movie, you will not get the idea the anti-war activists cared about the Vietnamese people at all. Like, it's not anything that comes out of their mouth. So he reads the names of the U.S. troops, and then people start standing up. And it's not just like that these people are died. It's that these Americans died, and this trial is really about them and how we should respect them and the troops. And even Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the prosecutor, stands up and everyone applauds. Right. It's literally and everyone stood up and applauded ending. Absolutely did not happen. Not an ending to a movie, by the way. That's not how a trial ends. That's not how a movie ends. Right. That's not how anything ends. Everyone stands up and applauds. Just he did not know how to finish the movie because he really didn't know like who the good guys or bad guys really were. And so it just sort of stops with this one of the laziest conceptions for a scene I've ever experienced.
I do think that it makes very clear who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
Yeah.
Even if we want to like problematize that and say that he makes it look like you can be a prosecutor and be a good guy. And we know that he wanted to show that by making the one of them feel conflicted. And as we keep laughing at, he wasn't feeling that way. But
and stand up for the troops.
Yeah. So what? But I mean, I was. When did you know this when you were watching that it didn't happen that way, or did you not know?
Yes. Yeah.
You knew it didn't happen that way, and you, Leslie,
I knew it didn't
you...
happen because I just saw it. I'm like, there's no way that funny. This actually happened. Right. There's no way.
Because I thought if it, what I thought was maybe interest, it would have been an interesting tool, but it rang untrue, especially because of the Vietnamese people not being part of the body count.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a clever tactic when you're, I think, like trying to appeal to this kind of problematic patriotism can be a good gateway drug to bring people in who are not anti-war, but that's kind of neither here nor there.
Yeah, because, yeah, it's the gateway. It's not the end of the movie, right? Like that's maybe where you start the
right,
movie
exactly, yeah,
from,
right.
But that's not where you end the movie.
I think it took it out of the narrative a little bit because I think that did happen.
Was it Dellinger? Dellinger read them.
Yeah, but it
right,
didn't happen.
Dellinger did, right.
It didn't happen at the end of the trial.
Yeah,
no, it was halfway through.
And also, they some of the people left in this rendition, right? So you have the bad guys leaving the courtroom. So like the head the attorney general, the head prosecutor leaves. He's like, "Why are you standing?" He's like, "Respect the fallen." That's like what the good prosecutor says. And then some people leave the room, but everyone else is standing for them. And then a really weird narrative thing happens, right? So they freeze frame it, I believe. And they freeze frame it, right? And with people's hands, fists raised and clapping to this. And then they read through, they have in text, they tell us about what happened to Bob B. Seale, what happened to Abby Hoffman, and what happened to, they don't tell us what happened to Dellinger.
No, they do. It's Ruben and, Hayden.
Yeah. And then, Ruben, Hayden, and Hoffman, right? And then, and Seal. And then after the freeze frame, after they've put that text in, I'm just looking to see how they do it. They then have more. Oh, and then William Consor, they tell us what happened to him. And then they have, and then it returns back to action. And then it ends.
A bizarre ending. And I felt like, as I was watching it, I was like, where are you going with this? Because you can't, like, read out 5,000 names in a film, but they just kept reading them. And I was like, where is this going though? And I was very unsure about that. And I feel like it ended, there was a really strong ending with Abby Hoffman taking the stand and quoting Lincoln, Lincoln's inaugural address from 1861, saying it's an American right, an American revolutionary right to overturn their government when they grow weary of the constitutional rights afforded them. And he says very strongly, and I don't know if Abby Hoffman actually said this, but I wouldn't be surprised if he did. He says that if Lincoln had given that speech in Lincoln Park last summer, he'd be put on trial like the rest of us.
Right.
And that was such a strong point to kind of let things simmer for a moment. But they just kind of launched into the next trial dates. And or I think he has like a couple ending points to say that Tom Hayden's a badass American hero or something.
Yeah, I know. That was so stupid.
What?
That's such a great point that you just made, because like if Abby bests Joseph Gordon-Levitt on the stand and that's kind of the end of the movie, then that's saying, oh wait, even like the worst, most annoying radical is still better than our handsome, good looking, morally conflicted prosecutor. That's a like putting your, you know, hand on the scale saying, all right, we're very clear about, and not that movies have to do that. Like not that movies have to tell you who the good guy, bad guys are, but when you're a movie that's ostensibly about like politics and real life politics and your movie like dampens so much and doesn't really dive as much into the depravity of how that this trial was going on, I don't know. I just would rather something like dumb and simple and obvious at some point, at some point, take a stand, you know?
Yeah. And I think Abby Hoffman's character in those final kind of words is really, really poignant there.
And it took place at Lincoln Park, right? In Chicago.
Yeah.
So that's another irony, right? Like very makes it that much more poignant.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a really strong point to kind of leave things on. And then you hand it over to like the good looking Eddie Redmayne Hayden, who stood for the judge when Bobby Seale was gagged.
Right.
And everybody hates him now because he's seen as this kind of conservative asshole who isn't really liberal or isn't really radical at all.
And then he just redeems himself, right?
And yeah, he's like, I'm sorry, are you saying that if I am brief and respectful and show remorse, then I get easier treatment? And then reads these lists, like these lists of names, like he's the hero. And it's like, well, hold on a minute. We all hated you 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Why do you get a redemption arc?
Yeah.
Yeah. It felt a little kind of contrived for me at that point.
Yeah. You know, by the way, Bob, do you know about Jerry Rubin's life after this? He became a stockbroker. He created business, something called Business Networking Salons, and which had parties at Studio 54. He became a yuppie, not a yippie.
It tracks with a lot of sort of radicals in that
pipeline
period, you know, as Americans went from trying to change the world to changing yourself and maybe that would change the world, people became much more narcissistic. And the moment that is 68 sort of dies out with a lot of all these people.
Yeah, he died. Then he died getting struck by a motorist trying to cross Wilshire Boulevard in front of his penthouse apartment. Kind of a sad, appropriate ending, though.
Yeah, this is very sad. I don't know if it was appropriate.
Well, it's appropriate to his becoming like this, you know,
sellout.
Yeah, sellout. I don't wish death on him, obviously. It's just an interesting metaphor.
Yeah.
That's something I really liked in the film, is the very visual, overstated metaphor that Abbie Hoffman is kind of narrating through between the inside of this bar where the 50s were happening and the outside of the bar where the 60s were happening. And he says that an unnecessary metaphor and they crash through the glass. I really liked that scene. I thought it was very on the nose, but forcing us to look at something that is very real and very important to remember when thinking about 1968 is that not everyone was necessarily living in the same 1968.
Nixon's silent majority, isn't it? Like Nixon won in 68. Then he won rapturously in 72. Like most people were against the people, Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. And I do think visually, as Vaughn has said, that Sorkin does this really, really well. He does it in The Trial, where you compare the prosecution to the defense. And you could see in the defense, people like Abbie Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, they dress very differently. They stick out. They're individualists. They're putting their legs up. Versus the prosecution, who were, you know, buttoned down, you know, sort of Frank Capra types. And there is that tension in the movie visually between those characters. But I don't think that the real ideas of the more idiosyncratic characters like Hoffman and Rubin are really put to the fore. Mm-hmm. I think Hoffman and Rubin, in many ways, they're sort of caricatures. They're funny. They wear robes and police garbs in the.
Oh, it's really funny. Yeah,
they're R2-D2 and C-3PO
instead of being intellectuals who have real critique of American life.
I would disagree with that because I think they portray Abbie Hoffman that way for a lot of the film. But somebody says early on he's smarter than you think he is.
Yeah, it's Weinglass says that to Hayden, I believe. Yeah.
Are that, but they play that role for a chunk of that movie.
But they also do in real life.
They actually wore
the judge's robes to court, and they a lot of the jokes that were in the film were quotes from Abbie Hoffman. So I think they played that pretty well, and Sacha Baron Cohen did a really good job of showing that kind of dichotomy that you can be intellectual, you can be intelligent, and still be radical and a yippie and live freely. You don't have to always put it on as a costume like Tom Hayden does, dressing the part, literally getting a haircut for the judge. Abbie Hoffman's you can do both. You can be smart and a badass.
Yeah, but they were countercultural pranksters, right? During the movie. But the only times that Abbie Hoffman's ideas really come out are when he's talking about, you know, cultural revolution very briefly with Tom Hayden, and then at the end when he talks about Lincoln. But in the actual trial, you have people like Rennie Davis actually engaging with the American Revolution and trying to compare the American Revolution to the revolution that they're opposing in 68. And you have Allen Ginsberg, doing that. You have Timothy Leary doing that. You have other activists actually doing that.
Right.
But in Sorkin's version, you have someone like Jerry Rubin who's like, I mean, unlike Abbie Hoffman, whose whole shtick is just to be someone who's funny. He has this funny side story with the FBI agent, but he doesn't really come across as a person.
You don't really have that context to see them more fully. Like, if this was a biopic about Abbie Hoffman, yeah, all those same jokes would be in there, but mm-hmm. we also get so much more of this. Instead, he's constantly contrasted against, you know, the more proper, right, you know, radical, and kind of gets pushed, you know, into this, you know, role of like a kind of comedic relief role, even though it could be so much more. So it's like, it's not that those scenes shouldn't be in there. It's just like the context of it really doesn't present a good, like a full character. They could
30 seconds. I actually think that they kind of both politically and dramatically want to show the spectrum, the political spectrum. And I do think that something that this is, I think, a good parallel of what Abbie Hoffman did in real life, which is that he brought you in through humor and fun and funniness and pranks, but then there really is a serious message. So I actually thought that was represented well. And then we get that insight into it where he basically says, like, this brings us press and the cameras. So I do think that Jerry, and you also, Jerry Rubin's invested with a lot of moral authority for trying to save this woman as she's about to be raped. So I think that it's very sympathetic towards them, but then it makes this corny, like, can we all on the left just get along? And then they do just get along because he and Tom Hayden resolve their differences and he gives him props in court and then Tom Hayden saves the day. So
Sorkin actually really believes that Tom Hayden and Abbie Hoffman interaction, where he says, you know, for 50 years, people are going to think the left is like you, instead of being like a serious movement for equality and poverty and things like that. And I think that Sorkin believes that's been borne out by the electoral defeats in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, and that he does not, by not really engaging with Abbie Hoffman's ideas. I mean, the thing about it is, like, Abbie Hoffman was a prankster. That you had people like the Merry Pranksters and people that Tom Wolfe followed around, but they were all also intellectuals. And for me, it just doesn't come out enough. Yeah.
All right, so that was the trial of the Chicago 7. Thank you so much for listening. Toby, Vaughn, where can people find you and hear your show?
So we're on Twitter at USA Impressions, and we also have a website, impressionsofamerica.com, where you can find all of our latest shows and some kind of articles that we write, some posters we've done. We're on Spotify, Apple, or iTunes, and Toby, anything else?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. I mean, we have a lot of interesting guests. Matt Christman, the artist from The Fair and Loathing, Ralph Steadman, journalists and intellectuals, and basically people from this community, people like Trash Futures, other podcasts like QAnon Anonymous, you know. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on. Katie, my co-hostess with the mostest, where can people find you on your other shows?
So you can find me on iTunes and Patreon, patreon.com/TheKatieHalper Show. You can also find me, I've started doing a live stream show, which Leslie has graced with his presence, which is on youtube.com/TheKatieHalper Show. And then on Twitter at KT Halps, that's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. And I'm also the co-host of Useful Idiots with Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone podcast.
Folks, that was Struggle Session. Have a good one.